And welcome to Managing Myeloma. My name is Nupur Rajay, and I'm going to discuss with you the current approaches to the diagnosis, risk stratification, and management of patients with smoldering multiple myeloma. Here are my disclosures. And just as a way of background, when does myeloma actually become active, or when is it symptomatic? I think all of you are familiar with the CRAB criteria, which is in essence stands for hypercalcemia, renal insufficiency, anemia, and bone disease. And obviously, when a patient presents with any of these CRAB criteria, the diagnosis is quite straightforward, and most of us, in fact, all of us, would actually treat these patients as if they had symptomatic active multiple myeloma. But when the disease is not active, we do have in this state a precursor disease state where you have the presence of a monoclonal protein and you do have increased plasmacytosis in patients. And this is referred to as monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. We do know that patients with MGUS have a risk of progression to active multiple myeloma. And if you look at this curve here, you will see that over a 30-year period or over 25 years, the risk of progression to symptomatic active multiple myeloma is about 30%, giving it about a 1% per year risk of progression to active disease. This is a spectrum of monoclonal plasma cell disorders, and as you all know and are beginning to appreciate and recognize, this is a dynamic spectrum. At the stage of MGUS, you have the presence of the monoclonal protein, and at the extreme other end is multiple myeloma, where you have the monoclonal protein as well as the development of end organ damage. And in between these two is the state of smoldering multiple myeloma, wherein patients have all the characteristics of myeloma without necessarily the end organ damage. This is just a incidence of all of these monoclonal gammopathies. And if you think about this, multiple myeloma accounts for about 18%, and smoldering multiple myeloma, which is what we are going to be discussing today, accounts for about 4% of patients with a monoclonal gammopathy. MGUS, as we've already discussed, is low clonal burden. There is the presence of the monoclonal protein. There is bone marrow plasmacytosis, typically less than 10%. And none of these patients have any of the organ-defining symptoms or characteristics defined by CRAB, as we've already discussed. So what about smoldering multiple myeloma? We talked about smoldering multiple myeloma being in between MGUS and multiple myeloma. It still remains an asymptomatic stage, and it's associated with a slightly increased clonal disease burden with the presence of a monoclonal protein in the serum or the urine, as well as an increase in bone marrow plasmacytosis. This has now been redefined. Anything more than 10% to up to 60% would fall into the category of smoldering myeloma. No end organ damage in the way of using an MRI or better imaging like PET scans without any evidence of focal disease. And typically, the evolution, as I've shown you with the MGUS, is about at a rate of 3% per year or so. So this is just explaining to you the progression spectrum of these plasma cell dyscrasias, where you have MGUS at one end and symptomatic multiple myeloma at the other end. And as you progress through this, you will see that the clonal proliferation increases, and with that comes an increase in genetic instability as well. And this is kind of depicted in this cartoon here, where you start off with a normal plasma cell. The normal plasma cell, when it goes into, if it is exposed to antigenic stimulation, either with an infection or any kind of inflammation, you can start having clonal proliferation. And at this stage, it is the genetic instability which causes clonal proliferation, which then allows the patient to transcend from the MGUS state to the multiple myeloma state. And as you progress through these stages, what you also see is certain oncogenes, certain genetic transformation as well. And out here, I'm just describing to you the MYC overexpression. So MYC, as you all know, is an oncogene which is relevant to myeloma progression. At the normal plasma cell or the MGUST level, MYC levels are very low. Once you have symptomatic multiple myeloma, either newly diagnosed or relapsed, you'll have an increase in MYC expression. This is a graph just showing you the progression of smoldering multiple myeloma patients to symptomatic myeloma. At the bottom, you have the MGUST progression, which we've already talked about. It's 1% per year, amounting to about 30% over 25 years. In contrast, if you look at patients with smoldering multiple myeloma, these patients in the first 5 years have a 50% risk of progression. And then, as you follow them long enough, if they've not progressed in the first 5 years, the chances of them progressing drops down dramatically to about 10% or so. And beyond this goes to about 5% or so. But the risk of progression from smoldering to multiple myeloma over the course of a patient's lifetime always does remain. So then the big question obviously is, can we predict this progression? So we've done a lot of work around trying to identify risk factors for progression, and those could be quantitative or qualitative. Quantitative mostly by the number of plasma cells, the amount of M protein, and bony abnormalities on advanced imaging. And qualitative is mostly what I talked to you about in terms of the genetic landscape and how these clonal plasma cells evolve genetically over time. And with that, we've come up with a hybrid version for risk of progression, where we look at abnormalities of free light chain ratios, we look at immunopoiesis, you look at circulating tumor cells, and you look at the evolving phenotype of these patients. There is a subset of patients which we define as ultra-high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients, and these patients were the ones who had a very high propensity to progress within the first year of their diagnosis of smoldering myeloma. And these then were defined as actually active myeloma. So we redefined what active symptomatic multiple myeloma should be. And in the newest classification, in addition to the CRAB criteria, which I've already described, the expanded definition of active symptomatic myeloma, although some of these don't present with symptoms, you would consider treating them because of the ultra-high-risk nature of these patients, is where you have a bone marrow plasmacytosis of more than 60%. You have a PET abnormality, even one lesion is enough. And if you have a free light chain ratio of above 100. These, in the newer definition of symptomatic multiple myeloma, would be considered symptomatic and would be patients who you would consider treating as if they had active symptomatic multiple myeloma. For smoldering multiple myeloma, also, we now have a revised risk stratification, and this revised risk stratification is the 22/20 model, where you're looking at bone marrow plasmacytosis of more than 20%, an M spike of greater than 2 grams, and a free light chain ratio of more than 20. Now, depending on the number of risk factors, you can then classify them into high risk, low risk, and intermediate. And I think this is really important because the high-risk patients have a 60% to 70% risk of progression to myeloma. And if there is anything we need to be doing about this patient population, it's this patient population that we are trying to address in clinical trials to try and alter the natural history of smoldering multiple myeloma patients. This is progression by risk. As you can see, the high-risk patients have nearly a 70% chance of progression. Intermediate and low risk fall somewhere in between. And this has also been adapted by the Spanish group, and this data which is presented by Marie-V Mateo, wherein she's identified high-risk patients based on a scoring system, wherein 70% to 80% of very high-risk patients can be identified by giving these patients these scores based on some of the parameters that we've already talked about. So once we know what the risk of progression is, the question obviously is, can we and should we be intervening, or should we be treating these patients any earlier? Now, this is still controversial and this is still debatable. And the reason why it is still remains a debate is smoldering myeloma is not a real disease. It's a transitional state somewhere between MGUS and multiple myeloma. And as I've already explained to you, these are asymptomatic patients. So to offer treatment completely to asymptomatic patients, we really need to understand the risk of their progression, and only then would we be subjecting them to treatment. And that's why I think it's so, so important to consider good risk stratification in the smoldering multiple myeloma space. So again, the question here is, why have we not been treating smoldering myeloma patients? Well, patients, as I've already mentioned, are asymptomatic. The counter argument to that can, in fact, be the fact that these are patients who, even if they're asymptomatic, sometimes symptoms can occur very rapidly. And these symptoms, specifically bony problems and kidney-related problems, can be catastrophic. We do not know who will actually develop symptomatic myeloma, because if you look at the best risk stratification, you know, we may be overtreating 30 or 40% of patients, and therefore better risk stratification needs to be accomplished. And the other argument could be, you know, treatments are not without toxicities. Everybody has a toxicity. Having said that, we now have highly effective treatments which are less toxic as well, which again makes the argument that maybe we should be considering treatment early. And to date, we haven't seen any improvement in survival of these patients. And we now have trials which we are doing. These are ongoing trials, and we will have data looking at overall survival as well. The trials are not yet mature when it comes to overall survival, but the hope is that we will be able to answer all of these questions in the very near future. So this is the data which sort of made us think about treating multiple myeloma patients. This is the Quiridex trial, which has now been published in the New England Journal of Medicine more than 7 or 8 years back now. This was patients with smoldering multiple myeloma who were treated with lenalidomide or who were observed. And if you look at the data out here, these were patients who had obviously an improved progression-free survival, but most importantly, also had and overall survival. Looking at this data, you know, it really made us think long and hard. And instead of adopting early intervention for all patients, we actually redefined what symptomatic multiple myeloma is, because this was a trial which showed us that patients who were progressing, and the reason why we were seeing a survival disadvantage in a smoldering multiple myeloma patients were a lot of patients were progressing with renal disease and bone disease, and therefore the new definition of symptomatic multiple myeloma, where we've included free light chain ratio as well as better imaging technology to look for bone disease here. This is the more recent study, which was presented and published by Dr. Lonial. This is the ECOG trial, E3A06. This was a phase 2-3 study wherein they took the Quiridex study. They used high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients, and then these were randomized to receive lenalidomide versus no treatment at all. And as is quite obvious, if you look at the patients who got lenalidomide, not surprisingly, the progression-free survival was better for patients who got lenalidomide. Response rates were better as well at a 3-year follow-up as well, suggesting that lenalidomide should be considered in the treatment of smoldering multiple myeloma patients. Why have we all not adopted this as standard of care? You know, lots of questions here, because we still don't have a survival advantage. There is toxicity associated with lenalidomide. And the big questions are, if we treat, should we be treating with a curative intent like we treat myeloma, or should we use a low intensity strategy as was shown in this ECOG trial with just lenalidomide alone? So obviously these are unanswered questions. If cure is the goal, we need to be more aggressive and not just control the disease. And what would we be using as a good surrogate for cure? The other question is, you know, these are asymptomatic patients. How long do we keep them on treatments which do impact patients' quality of life? So lots of questions in this space, and that's why I don't think we still have a clear-cut answer as to who needs to be treated for smoldering multiple myeloma. There are other approaches being used, and I'm just going to mention one of them, which is the vaccine approach, which we're using at our center at Mass General. What we've identified is a peptide-based vaccine. After looking at a whole bunch of clonal plasma cells, we identified several proteins which were antigenic, and then we identified these peptides, which we could put into a vaccination strategy. What we were able to see quite nicely with this approach is that when we give the patients a vaccine, and you think about it as if you're getting the flu shot, you get the flu shot so that you prevent getting the flu. The idea behind PBX410 is you get the this vaccine and you prevent the development of active symptomatic multiple myeloma. So we have used this vaccination approach in smoldering multiple myeloma patients with the idea of seeing an immune response in these patients. And when we use this tripeptide vaccine, we were able to show an induction of peptide-specific CTLs, suggesting that patients are able to mount an immune response. Obviously, we need to look at long-term data, and we need to see whether we can actually change the natural history of this disease and not prevent the progression to multiple myeloma. So this is one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, we are treating smoldering myeloma as if they have active myeloma. This is the GEM-CSR study. We're using a triplet combination, you're using an autologous transplant, and you're using a curative approach with the intent that at the smoldering myeloma stage, where there is not that much of genetic evolution, if you are going to be thinking about curing the disease, this is the platform to consider, and therefore use this approach so that you can get rid of this disease. So this is an ongoing trial as we speak, and we'll have to wait and see what the data unfolds. There's several other trials we're looking at as well, wherein we're looking at overall survival as an outcome. This is an ECOG study looking at the use of daratumumab to enhance the effectiveness of lenalidomide. This is a follow-up study to the other ECOG trial that I've just mentioned. This is called the Deter Smoldering Myeloma trial. And as the name suggests, we want to deter patients from progressing on to developing full-blown myeloma. So with all of this, what should we be doing today? Obviously, we need to confirm the diagnosis, and I've shown you how you can confirm the diagnosis. We need to try and identify who those ultra-high-risk patients are, and those ultra-high-risk patients certainly would be considered for active myeloma treatment. We should also be considering who the high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients are, and in my mind, even today in 2020, we should be considering using a clinical trial as the treatment, and there is no real standard of care for the treatment of these patients. So standard risk smoldering myeloma patients certainly need to be observed. They need to be followed, and the recommendation is that they need to be followed every 3 months with all their parameters. If they have multiple high-risk features, I've already mentioned this, you know, these would be somebody you would consider extremely close follow-up or almost consider treatment as if they had active multiple myeloma. So in general, I think once you've diagnosed smoldering myeloma, you have to have very careful follow-up. You really have to identify risk factors in these patients, because the risk of progression does not diminish over time. These patients require lifelong follow-up, and the least amount of time between follow-up in these patients is about 3 months or so. And the other thing which is really important to appreciate here is risk can evolve over time, and the risk factors for progression need to be followed extremely closely in this patient population. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for your attention, and thank you for tuning in to this presentation.